Honor the dead by helping the living. That's not only your motto, but that's what you've been all about. That's what my guys and women from Delaware have been about from the time I was introduced to them in the middle of another war, Vietnam. Like you, like them, I know that our nation has but one truly sacred obligation. We have many obligations as a nation, but only one truly sacred obligation, and that is to prepare and equip those whom we send into harm's way and to care for them and their families when they come home. Tommy, the commander, you've not only known that, you've lived that. You served bravely in Vietnam and then came back to keep right on fighting to make sure your comrades got everything they deserved. I want to personally thank you, and on behalf of the President, thank you for the service, not only over there, but here. And to Jan Tittle, every man out here knows, and every woman in the VFW knows, that they would not function very well were it not for the ladies' auxiliary. And that's not hyperbole. That's a fact. And Richard Eubank, who has a magnificent family, by the way, I just got to meet them all, who served at the height of the Vietnam War, I want to wish you the best of luck as you take the helm of this great organization at what I would argue would be one of the most critical points in its history. To Adjutant General Wallace, thanks for having me. And thanks for all you do on behalf of the VFW every single day in Washington. And thank you particularly for your continuing work on the POW-MIA issue. And to my home state commander, Bob Wilkinson, and to the ladies' auxiliary, Roberta Walker, President, I want to thank you for all you've done for the state of Delaware and all you've done for the veterans of Delaware over your careers. I particularly want to acknowledge those veterans of the Korean War, who this summer are marking the 60th anniversary of the start of that conflict. Over 111 years, from San Juan Hill to the Argonne Forest, from Midway to Incheon, from Way City to Kuwait City, from the Korangal Valley to the Sunni Triangle, VFW members have fought for our country on both the front lines and the home front. You and your predecessors helped establish the Department of Veterans Affairs and build a national cemetery system. You worked to secure a better future for service members and their families by helping pass two GI bills. You've spoken out time and again on behalf of the 2.2 million members, ranks that continue to swell, and for all those who have fought in America's wars. This work, your work, and this is not hyperbole, this work and your work has never been more important than this very day. Over the past decade, our military embarked on a longer period of sustained combat than any time in all of American history. More than 2 million service members have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, more than half of whom have returned to civilian life with the honored title of veteran. Of those men and women, the very best of this nation, almost 40,000 have been wounded, and over 5,641, and it's important to get the exact number, for as I speak, God only knows what's happened today. Over 5,041 have made the ultimate sacrifice for their beloved country. And today, in this month, as you heard a little bit from my friend General Petraeus, and as you heard from the President, we're taking a major step toward concluding one of those wars, just as pledged before he took office. 1 month after his inauguration at Camp Lejeune, President Obama laid out our plan for ending the war in Iraq responsibly. And we followed that plan very closely because of the significant help and leadership of our military. As a result, 1 week from tomorrow, U.S. combat forces will phase out their combat mission as we begin to bring the combat phase of this war to a close. More than 140,000 troops were in Iraq on Inauguration Day. By the end of August, 50,000 will remain. Our last remaining — applaud them. They deserve it. Our last remaining combat unit, one that I know personally well from visiting them in Fort Lewis, to be there as they mourned their dead, to being with them and in their vehicles in Iraq, the 4th Stryker Brigade of the Army's 2nd Infantry Division, that last unit crossed the border out of Iraq. I'm proud to say that as of September 1st, the mission of the United States forces in Iraq will move from combat to advise, assist, train, and equip the Iraqi military forces to conduct partnered counterterrorism operations and to provide security for our military and civilian personnel and the infrastructure in Iraq. I recently had the great honor of doing what Jill and I have been doing since I became Vice President, and quite frankly, before, of visiting Army posts and all military posts all across the nation and around the world. Just last month, I headed up to Watertown, New York, to Fort Drum. Go ahead, they deserve it. I met with the Army's proud 10th Mountain Division, whose motto is, "Climb to Glory." And God have they climbed to glory in some of the most God-forsaken parts of the world. And they've done it in a way that's not only exemplary, but would make you so proud. I was there to welcome home nearly 3,000 of them back from Iraq 3 months earlier than they were going to come back because they accomplished all their goals ahead of time. These homecomings are something I have long looked forward to, as I know many of you have. We have an outfit in Delaware called Boots on the Ground, started by a group of women in Delaware who said, like my wife said, they were not going to be part of anything like happened in their generation, where veterans came home and backs were turned and people actually spat upon them. But to make sure that every single solitary veteran coming home to Delaware, every military personnel coming back from service, was greeted with some fanfare and appreciation. Folks, only 1% of the nation is fighting these wars. But as my wife says on every television program she goes on, 100% of the nation owes them a thank you. 100% of the nation can do something to acknowledge what they do. I must tell you, my guys from Delaware know this, it surprised me. The day my son, Captain Beau Biden, returned home from a year-long tour in Iraq, I watched him embrace his wife and his children, and it surprised me how emotional it was. It was one of the proudest and happiest moments of my entire life. That's the case for every Blue Star mother and father, husband and wife. By the end of next year, 2011, our remaining troops in Iraq will have come home to their families and to a grateful nation. And this is only possible because of the extraordinary progress of our military. And I might say, I hope no one's offended. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the finest, most fierce group of warriors this nation has ever created in our entire history. Their success is not an accident. Their success is because of the man you just saw on your screen and a courageous four-star general in Iraq named Ray Odierno. Ladies and gentlemen, three things they have accomplished so far, and they're worth singling out. First, violence in Iraq has decreased to such a degree that that good-looking young man who looks like in the kind of shape I thought I was when I was his age, but never was, who served in Iraq in 5 and 6 or 4 and 5, you would not recognize the country today, thankfully. The country then was being torn apart by sectarian conflict. You'd hardly recognize it today. Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Shiite extremists remain dangerous, and their attacks still claim innocent lives. But they have utterly failed to achieve their objective, which was to inflame an additional round of sectarian conflict and undermine the election that just took place and stop the formation of a new government. They have failed. Secondly, Iraq's security forces, now 650,000 strong, and of my 13 trips to Iraq, 5 were with General Petraeus, who was then in charge of that process, which was halting and difficult and painful. But today, they are 650,000 strong and already leading the way to defend and protect their country. We have transferred control over hundreds of bases and many thousands of square miles of territory. Some said that our drawdown would bring about more violence. Well, they were wrong, because the Iraqis are ready to take charge. And in the recent months, operations that they have led, based on intelligence they have garnered, killed 2 key Iraqi leaders, the top 2, and purged more than 30 other Al-Qaeda top terrorists from their ranks. Thirdly, no less important, is the fact that Iraqi leaders who once settled their disputes through violence are at this very moment as I speak, because I have recently spoken to every one of them individually, are sitting down in the torturous process of ironing out their difference in face-to-face negotiations. The Iraqis recently held a second election, and I know I'm often quoted for saying, in establishing a democracy, the most important election is not the first election. It's the second election, an election made possible by the sacrifices of American men and women, an election that the entire world agreed was legitimate. And although it's taking a long time to form a government, I facetiously point out to my friends that it took the Dutch parliament 5 months to form their government, I am absolutely convinced that they're on the way to doing that. Another way of putting this is that politics and not war has broken out in Iraq. Now, I certainly don't need to tell you that politics isn't always pretty, even our own. But the hard work of forming a new government is well underway, and we, and I personally, at the President's request and General Odierno's request, I personally have made it clear to the leading politicians that it's time for them to match the courage of their citizens by completing this process. Ever since the President asked me last year to oversee Iraq policy, I've been actively engaged on a daily basis. I've visited 4 times since then and 13 times in all. I've come to know the players of all the leading coalitions, and I speak regularly to each of them. and I understand their intricate politics. We have a first-rate embassy team in place, led by Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, that is interacting on a daily basis, actually wordsmithing with them as they work through the process of government formation. Many people point, and I watched on television this Sunday, talked about Iranian influence. Well, let me tell you something. Iranian influence in Iraq is minimal. It's been greatly exaggerated. The Iranian government spent over $100 million trying to affect the outcome of this last election, to sway the Iraqi people, and they utterly failed. And it's because politics and nationalism has broken out in Iraq. The Iraqi people voted for the desired candidates, none of whom, let me emphasize this, none of whom were wanted by Iran. Maliki is persona non grata in Iran. Alawi is persona non grata in Iran. Barzani, none of their candidates succeeded. And now, those who won, none having won an overwhelming majority. Remember, this is a parliament, a parliamentary system, 320 members of their core, they call it, going to 350-something. And no one party got more than 91 votes. And now they're working to form a government. And every day I'm urging them, and we are urging them, to do so in a way that reflects the outcome of the election, which means that Maliki's party is called State of Law and Alawi's party called Iraqiya are going to have to be the nucleus of any new government. But it's difficult. They've never had a government like this before. And a very important step in the process that's not talked about much is taking place as I speak and has been for the last 3 weeks. And that is a formal written agreement on power sharing, the limits of the power of the prime minister, the power of their presidency, the power of their National Security Council. That is the first step in making sure that whatever the government leaders are who occupy those seats will be able to have a workable, functioning government that does not lend itself to the ability to be hijacked. This process can sometimes be frustrating, and there are ups and downs. But I'm here to tell you I am absolutely confident that Iraq will form a national unity government that will be able to sustain that country. And one more thing. Drawing down our troops in Iraq does not mean we are disengaging from Iraq. In fact, quite the opposite is true. We're in the process of following on President Bush's proposal for a long-term relationship, a security, long-term security and economic agreement with the Iraqis. While our warriors that remain there, 50,000, are as capable as any armed service in the world. They know how to fight if they have to. Their mission has changed. They are now there to help Iraqis help themselves. And meanwhile, we're ramping up our civilian-led effort to ensure Iraqis remain stable, sovereign, and self-reliant. We're opening up consulates in Basra and up in Erbil, which will be heavily populated. We're going to continue to help strengthen their economic and political institutions and foster new ties of trade and commerce and support Iraq's return to its rightful place in the region and the broader community of nations. While the Iraq war winds down, our troops continue to take the fight to our enemies in Afghanistan. That's where al-Qaeda plotted and trained to launch the devastating attack on 9/11. Our forces there are now in the able hands of one of the finest generals, David Petraeus, a great warrior, a strategist, and a friend who you are honoring this week with the Eisenhower Award. Afghanistan poses different and unique problems and daunting challenges, including a local population scarred by more than three decades of war, plagued by illiteracy, crushing poverty, and rampant corruption. The country's harsh terrain is one of the least hospitable in all of the world, as other countries over centuries can tell you. I've seen it firsthand, including 2 years ago, when a sudden snow squall, when I was with General Rodriguez, forced our helicopter to land between two jagged peaks, 9,000 feet above sea level, on a road not much wider than the width of our roto blades, with a descent on one side of about 1,800 feet and another 900. And the next mountain range less than a mile away, they're just jagged pieces of rock. And that's where the 10th Mountain Division, that's where the 1st Cav, that's where these kids have had to climb with 60 pounds of gear or more and engage Al-Qaeda. These kids, they're not kids, these women and men, they are fierce warriors. And they are now in one of the most fierce terrains in all the world. But after too many years of neglect, we finally now have clearly defined a strategy backed by the resources needed to implement it. And we are making measurable progress on the overarching goal we have in Afghanistan: to disrupt, to dismantle, and to defeat Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In order to do this, we must deny Al-Qaeda safe haven, and we must reverse the Taliban's momentum as we strengthen the capacity of Afghan security forces and the government so they can begin the long, painful process of assuming, over time, ultimate responsibility for this country's future. We cannot want peace and security in Afghanistan more than they want. Nearly all the additional personnel, when we took office, there were fewer than 30,000 personnel there. This month, we've ramped up to 100,000 American forces and 10,000, about 10,000 new troops and trainers provided by our allies for the International Security Assistance Forces. General Petraeus, now, only now, has all the resources and the strategy called for. So all this talk about the inability to succeed is premature. Only now, this month, has General Petraeus finally gotten what the military told the President and me they need to succeed in that mission. And General Petraeus is working tirelessly. I might add, he made a great sacrifice. All of you who are military know, going from being CENTCOM commander back to operational commander in Afghanistan was a sacrifice. And in a technical way, a step down from commanding all of Central Command to focusing only on Afghanistan. But it is the most intractable problem we face, and it needed the best general we have. And we now have it. So, folks, don't buy into. We have failed in Afghanistan. We now are only beginning. With the right general and the right number of forces to seek our objectives. General Petraeus is working tirelessly to strengthen the Afghan security force, and it is a daunting undertaking. And to take insurgents on in regions where they have run roughshod for too long. This effort is being complemented by an unprecedented surge of civilian diplomats and technical experts. And our ambassador, by the way, who was a former commander in Afghanistan, a three-star general, General Carl Eikenberry, a warrior in his own right, He is working every single day, pushing the Afghan government to step up its efforts to tackle corruption and devise a plan for reintegration with a portion of the Taliban that's ready to accept the Afghan constitution. As General Petraeus has said, we will assess the progress in December and begin a responsible, conditions-based transition to Afghan security leadership on a province-by-province basis in July of 2011. Everybody says, is that an end date? It is not. We are not leaving in 2011. We are beginning the transition. And why the date? The date is important to make as important to the Iraqis, because we wanted to make clear to them, they must step up. They must exercise sovereignty if they're ever going to prevail. And also, we stated as a goal that we should strive for. In the meantime, our thoughts and prayers remain with those troops still serving in harm's way, and we'll continue to give them the resources they need to succeed. But as you know better than anyone, providing for our service members overseas is only where our responsibility begins, not where it ends. That's why our administration has embarked on one of the largest, most comprehensive programs in American history to support our returning veterans, their families, long after their military service is over. President Obama trusted another great warrior, General Eric Shinseki. Some of you probably served under General Shinseki. He charged him with transforming the Department of Veterans Affairs to meet the new and different needs of the 21st century. If we could hold a second here, one of the things I want to point out, I have visited the burn center in Fort Bliss. We have all the wounded warriors who come over, multiple amputees, to our home for Thanksgiving dinner. We spend Christmas. This is a different war, folks. There are a different set of injuries. There's a different imperative. We have to adjust to what it is so we don't make the mistakes we have made as a nation with past generations of warriors. We're providing General Shinseki with the resources to do exactly that, build a 21st century response. Even while freezing most discretionary spending in the budget, we have given the VA one of the biggest budget increases they've had in 30 years, as your adjutant can tell you, $16 billion this year. For a total of over $114 billion. We follow that up with a request for another increase next year of another $11 billion on top of that. We do that because the need is real. The need is apparent, and the need requires an obligation to meet it. I know I hear some voices, and we'll hear voices. We'll continue to hear them who say, in these tough economic times, how can we so incredibly increase that money? But I say to those voices, whether or not we keep the promise to our veterans, will say more about who we are as a nation than anything else we will do. In my view, our nation to the veterans is not negotiable. It's a sacred obligation. And meanwhile, the post 9/11 GI Bill is already helping nearly 300,000 veterans. And for the first time, their family members earn a college degree. We're revitalizing the VA facilities, including $957 million more to the already admirable Veterans Health Administration and $46 million for the VA cemeteries and national shrines that must be preserved and that you are responsible for occurring in the first place. We've taken steps to help veterans opposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam and those who suffer from a range of ailments related to their service in the first Gulf War. Tommy, Richard, and all those who served in Vietnam, remember how veterans from our generation had to prove the source of their ailments in order to get their benefits. the burden was placed on them. Well, thanks in part to the hard work of this organization, that burden will no longer be placed on them. The burden is on the government to deny the benefit, not for them to prove they're entitled to the benefit. And also, thanks for your help. We will not make the same mistake we made with these younger veterans that we made in the past. For those with post-traumatic stress disorder, our policy will be to trust veterans' own explanation of how that came about without requiring them to prove in detail where it occurred. The fact is, it exists. And we're implementing a new rating system to prove how claims for traumatic brain injury can be evaluated. We're doing these things because wounded veterans should not have to plead for the care they deserve. They should not have to do that. Two landmark pieces of legislation deserve special mention, and not just because you all were instrumental in both their success. For the first time in American history, we've secured advanced appropriations to end, once and for all, the nightmare of long delays in funding for veterans' medical treatment. And that's because of you. And since sometimes the best care comes from a family member, I need not tell all of you that. We passed the Caregivers and Veterans Omnibus Service Act to fund and train relatives who serve as caregivers for their wounded warriors. These are incredible young women and men. Like me, many of you visit on a regular basis our hospitals to see our wounded warriors. I was recently at a hospital, and the nurses were taking me around to tell me the veterans who were severely wounded who wanted to see me. We walked into a young veteran's, young officer's room. He was there with his wife, beautiful young woman, smart. And he was, I'd say, 31, late 20s, early 30s. He had lost one leg, almost at the hip, and the other just below the knee. And his left hand was mangled. And he was asleep. And I said to the nurse and the doctor, no, no, don't wake him up. And they said, he'll really be offended if you don't. So they woke him up and I walked in. And this kid reached up in that triangle above his bed and pulled himself with the right hand and, sir, looked at me, said, sir, I apologize. It was my intention to be able to stand and salute you when you came. No self-pity. No, why me? Like hundreds of these young women and men that I've met with. You know what I most often get asked? When I say, can I do anything for you? The response I get most often is, Mr. Vice President, they pull you close. Can you help me get back to my unit? Can you help me get back to my unit? What a remarkable generation of warriors. Not part of what I planned on telling you, but a good friend of mine, Colin Powell, called me and said, Joe, have you read the new book, War? Read it, gentlemen, ladies. It tells a story in a way that I've seen some of it firsthand that is beyond my ability to describe. Almost 18,000 men and women have been wounded so badly in Iraq and Afghanistan that, quite frankly, had they had the same wounds in Vietnam, they would not have lived. They've been unable to return to duty, these 18,000 out of the 40. The good news is the medical advances and improved technologies have allowed so many of them to survive, as I said, who may have passed in previous encounters. But it also means that they are left with injuries that's going to require critical care for the rest of their lives, and their average life expectancy would be 35 years. You and I know very well, long after these wars are over, God willing, and the welcome home parades are finished, and the memorials are built, and the streets are renamed, you and your fellow veterans organizations are still going to be so badly needed out there, demanding that these wounded warriors get the care they need for decades from now. Because the estimated cost is, it will cost just for those 18,000, someone in excess of $7 billion over their lifetime to provide them the critical care they need. And I'm here to tell you, I, for one, am counting on you. An entire generation of veterans, my son's generation, is counting on you. For you know better than any group of Americans, we owe them nothing less, because the warriors we sent to Iraq and Afghanistan have served as ably as any generation of fighting women and men in our nation's history. The sacred obligation I mentioned earlier extends also to those who share the burdens of veteran service. That's why the First Lady and my wife, Jill, have spent so much time leading an unprecedented push for our nation to support and engage our military families. My wife is so dedicated to this, and the Delawareans know this is a woman who used to get embarrassed or frightened standing up and speaking to 30 people. Actually, when they asked her to go on Army Wives, said, yes, I nearly died. And she said, Joe, it's one of the most popular programs, and if I can do anything to convince the American people they need to help, as she says, just do one act of kindness. One act of kindness. Cut that National Guard mother's or wife's lawn while he's deployed in Afghanistan or Iraq. Say thank you. Say thank you. You all are veterans. You know better than I how much it means. Over nearly a decade, military families have endured multiple deployments unlike any time in our history. And the wrenching toll that absence takes on their children, their marriages, and their mental health. It's only when our son Beau went to Iraq for a year that Jill and I came to understand what the poet John Milton meant when he said, and I quote, famous quote of John Milton, he said, they also serve who only stand and wait. They also serve who only stand and wait. Well, multiple millions of women and men, fathers, mothers, husbands, grandparents, sons and daughters have served in these two wars. Our military families do far more than stand and wait. We owe them for their service to our countries, and we must acknowledge and repay that debt. It's no secret that today, more than ever, a small fraction of our citizens bear the lion's share of the cost these wars have imposed, and their call to duty has been answered by a new generation of heroes every bit as honorable as those who have come before. Heroes like Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kalender, who I met in a FOB, forward operating base, in a remote godforsaken piece of the Konar Valley, I don't know how many thousand feet above sea level, just a few miles from the Pakistani border. With the heart of a warrior and the precision of a cultural anthropologist, he and his soldiers talked me through a myriad of tribes and sub-tribes that inhabited the terrain and the near constant enemy fire they endured at night sitting on that exposed mountaintop. Six of them sitting up there in God-forsaken nowhere. or heroes like the 7 servicemen who last week were awarded the Silver Star for valorous acts more awe-inspiring than any Hollywood movie could conjure up. One of them, Sergeant First Class David Nunes, was traveling through Afghanistan village of Sherwan on May 29, 2008, when the insurgents attacked. His body became totally engulfed in flames as he sought to save his comrades' lives by ridding a damaged vehicle he was in of the ammunition and explosives, as he tried rapidly to get it out of the back of the vehicle because they were trapped in. He gave his life. These stories are chapters in the greatest epic of our age. They will inspire future warriors as surely as did those in this room who fought and bled in wars gone by. But our enemies should take a different message from this sacrifice. They should take a message that it's irrefutable proof of our resolve in the face of the new threats we now confront. As President Obama said, our spirit is strong and it cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. So on behalf of a grateful nation, I thank all of our troops and all of you here today for giving life to those words and for sacrificing so much for our country. May God bless you all. May God bless America. And may God, most of all, protect our troops. Thank you for having me.